Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Around the world, some 160 million children work to earn a living instead of going to school. That's almost one in every 10 children. On Monday's World Day Against Child Labour, the International Labour Organization, ILO, shared these staggering numbers as a reminder of the urgency to end this practice. ILO's Director General, Gilbert Ungbo, said that for the first time in 20 years, child labour is on the rise. Child labour rarely happens because parents are bad or do not care. Rather, it springs from a lack of social justice, he said. Mr. Ungbo stressed that tackling the root causes of child labour requires creating decent work opportunities for adults so that they can provide for their families, ending forced labour, creating safe and healthy workplaces, letting workers organize and make their voices heard, as well as ending discrimination, since child labour often affects the most marginalized. Heavy rains and thunderstorms in the area of the Kakhovka Dam disaster in southern Ukraine are aggravating the humanitarian situation there and making evacuations and aid distribution harder. That's the latest from the UN's Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, which tweeted on Monday that the UN and its humanitarian partners have delivered vital supplies, mainly water, hygiene items and food, to cover the needs of nearly 180,000 people despite the difficult conditions. The number of people reached with aid is up fivefold since the 9th of June. Drinking water continues to be an issue, and long-term solutions are needed immediately, the UN's top official in the country, Denise Brown, said on Sunday, speaking from an evacuation point in Kherson City. Meanwhile, the UN's nuclear safety watchdog, IAEA, has stressed the need to clarify the reason for a significant discrepancy between different measurements of the height of the reservoir whose water cools the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant occupied by Russia. The level has been dropping rapidly since the Kakhovka Dam, situated not far downstream from the power plant, was destroyed. The head of the UN's cultural agency, UNESCO, announced on Monday that the United States has decided to rejoin the organization next month after having stopped all funding in 2011 and fully withdrawn almost 6 years ago. UNESCO Director General Audrey Azoulay told member states that the decision was a strong act of confidence in UNESCO and in multilateralism and in the way that the agency was implementing its mandate on culture, education, science and information. UNESCO said that in a letter sent to Ms. Azoulay, the U.S. State Department welcomed the way in which UNESCO had addressed in recent years emerging challenges, modernized its management, and reduced political tensions. The country stopped funding UNESCO in 2011 after the organization extended membership to Palestine. At the time, U.S. funding made up 22% of the agency's budget. The United States is a founding member of UNESCO and had withdrawn once before in 1984, then rejoined in 2003. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think.
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is Radio Free Kansas.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day. It is a chilly 64 degrees. Started out about 50 degrees at sunrise this morning. Amazing. It's beautiful weather, really. We all should be out there doing something in the outside, that's for sure. I feel that tug. Boy, it's also a big news day. Tuesday, former President Donnie is getting indicted today. I'm looking at the Washington Post Live YouTube feed. Very boring. I saw an earlier local Florida television station broadcasting from a helicopter at the quote-unquote protest. we'll talk about that in the second hour with John Grant. So in the meantime, we have our great lineup here coming up. The latest headlines from this morning's Democracy Now! Broadcast. Let's see, I picked that up off YouTube. However, it is available here now in Topeka at the PBS affiliate on air antenna 11.1 through 4. That's 11 point channel 11 in Topeka. You can get Amy Goodman at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I believe. I'm going to double check that for you, but it's right around 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. And here at the local Kansas City PBS affiliate, on 19.2 over the air channel, 19.2 at 7 in the morning. You can get the complete broadcast of Democracy Now! All I ever give you and all we here at Radio Free Kansas will ever give you is the headlines, the top headlines. Then following this morning's top headlines of Democracy Now!, we're going to have Counterspin hosted by Janine Jackson. And that'll pick up, and then I'll be back with you maybe during the music interlude after Counterspin. In the meantime, enjoy the news.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Donald Trump surrendering to federal authorities in Miami, Florida today to face charges for retaining and mishandling classified documents, including top secret information about U.S. nuclear weapons. In recent days, Trump and many of his supporters have condemned the charges using inflammatory language. Ahead of Trump's arraignment, Miami Police Chief Manny Morales said law enforcement officials are preparing for the possibility of violence by far-right extremists outside Miami's federal courthouse.
Make no mistake about it, we're taking this this event extremely serious. We know that there is a potential of things taking a turn for the worst, but that's not the Miami way.
Trump, who's currently the front runner for the Republican Party's 2024 presidential nominations, planning to fly to his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, after his Florida arraignment to deliver remarks this evening. After headlines, we'll have the latest on the federal indictment against Trump. We'll speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, expert on fascism and authoritarianism. In Ukraine, at least 10 people were killed, more than 24 injured overnight as Russia launched a massive missile attack on the central city of Kryvyi Rih. Victims included residents of a partially collapsed five-story apartment building where rescue crews said people could still be trapped under rubble. Ukraine's military, meanwhile, says it's retaken 7 settlements in the Donetsk and Zaporizhia regions in a counteroffensive over the past week. NATO's opened its largest ever aerial war games in Germany. The military alliance says some 10,000 personnel from 25 countries are taking part in drills involving 250 warplanes. Non-NATO nations Japan and Sweden are participating. The war games opened as French President Emmanuel Macron welcomed German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Polish President Duda to Paris, where the three discussed aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg delayed Monday's planned visit with President Joe Biden by a day after Biden had emergency surgery, root canal. On Saturday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made a surprise visit to Kyiv, where he met President Volodymyr Zelensky and addressed Ukraine's parliament. Trudeau pledged $500 million in new military aid and said he would support Ukraine's bid to join NATO during the alliance's July summit in Vilnius, Lithuania.
Canada and many others are very supportive of Ukraine joining NATO when the conditions allow. What that exactly looks like is a conversation that we're continuing to have between now and Vilnius, but I'm very positive about it.
The world's nuclear powers spent nearly $44 billion on weapons of mass destruction last year, or more than $157,000 per minute, with the United States accounting for more nuclear weapons spending than all other nations combined. That's the finding of a new report by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. The Nobel Peace Prize-winning group found worldwide spending on nuclear weapons rose last year for the third consecutive year. Iran's supreme leader has said he's open to reviving the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from under President Trump in 2018. On Sunday, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said there was nothing wrong with pursuing a revival of the agreement as long as Iran can keep its nuclear infrastructure intact. Khamenei spoke after touring an exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry in Tehran.
Based upon Islamic ideals, we do not want nuclear weapons. But if this wasn't the case, they would not be able to prevent us from doing so, just like they could not prevent our nuclear progress so far.
Human rights groups warn Iran is executing prisoners at its fastest pace in nearly a decade. Over the weekend, at least five prisoners were hanged in Iran. This follows 282 executions carried out in May, nearly double the number recorded during the same time last year. The use of capital punishment in Iran has surged in the months after historic massive protests took to the streets following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody last September. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the UN reports more than 45 people were killed after an attack on a camp for internally displaced communities. The camp, located near a UN peacekeeping site in the Jugu territory, was reportedly infiltrated by fighters of a coalition of armed groups Sunday who carried out the massacre through the early hours of Monday. The victims were buried in a mass grave. The UN called the attack a serious violation of international humanitarian law. UNESCO says the United States will rejoin the United Nations Cultural and Scientific Agency and will pay more than $600 million in back dues. In 2017, the Trump administration announced it would withdraw the U.S. from UNESCO, citing what it called anti-Israel bias. Israel followed suit immediately after. Both the U.S. and Israel stopped paying member dues in 2011 after Palestine joined UNESCO. In climate news, tens of thousands of dead fish have washed ashore across multiple beaches along the Texas Gulf Coast after they were starved of oxygen due to abnormally warm ocean temperatures. In 2019, the UN warned the climate crisis will increasingly lead to massive die-offs of marine life as warm water holds far less oxygen than colder water. This comes as more than 430 wildfires continue to burn across Canada, with thousands of people in Alberta, British Columbia, and Quebec still under evacuation orders. Quebec's Minister of Public Security said the blazes will likely last all summer, with more air quality alerts likely across the northern U.S. and Canada. Last Wednesday, a thick, dark smoke from Canada's fires blanketed New York City. Over 300 people were seen at hospitals due to symptoms of asthma, nearly double the number seen the day before the smoke arrived. The highest rate of emergencies were reported in predominantly low-income Black and Latinx neighborhoods. In Montana, a landmark climate trial led by 16 children and young adults began Monday in the capital, Helena. The lawsuit, which is the first of its kind to go to trial in the U.S., was filed in 2020 by plaintiffs between the ages of 5 and 22. They accused the state of Montana of violating their constitutional rights as it pushed pro-fossil fuel policies that devastated the environment and severely impacted their health. This is Julia Olson, executive director of Our Children's Trust, the nonprofit law firm representing the young plaintiffs.
Children need lawyers, and they need advocates, because our system of law does not prioritize the needs of the youngest among us. And when it comes to climate crisis, human laws are not paying attention to the laws of nature and what scientists say is necessary to protect our children and all future generations.
Earlier this month, a judge cleared the way for a children's climate case against the United States government to begin in a federal court in Oregon after Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts blocked the lawsuit in 2018. J.P. Morgan Chase has agreed to pay $290 million to settle a lawsuit brought by survivors of convicted sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who said the bank ignored warnings about Epstein's sexual abuses for years because he was bringing in wealthy clients. J.P. Morgan Chase still faces a separate lawsuit brought by the U.S. Virgin Islands, where the Attorney General's office said in a statement it'll proceed with its enforcement action to, quote, prevent the bank from assisting and profiting from human trafficking in the future, unquote. And in Pennsylvania, authorities have recovered the body of a tanker truck driver who died after he lost control of his rig and crashed Sunday morning, triggering a fire that collapsed an overpass on Interstate 95 in Philadelphia. The disaster has halted traffic in both directions along the main East Coast artery connecting Florida to Maine. On Monday, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said officials would have a timeline for its reconstruction once engineers complete a review in the coming days.
With regards to the complete rebuild of I-95 roadway, we expect that to take some number of months.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, this country has a long history of weaponizing drug laws against black and brown communities. Harry Anslinger, the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, ran an anti-marijuana crusade in the 1930s, saying, quote, "Reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men," close quote. Concerns then are justified about what the legalization and profitizing of marijuana means for the people and communities most harmed by its criminalization. We'll hear about that from Tahid Chappelle, founder of the Philadelphia Cannabis Association and a project manager for Free Press's News Voices project. Also on the show, lots of people are concerned about what's called the digital well-being of children, their safety and privacy online. So why did more than 90 human rights and LGBTQ plus groups sign a letter opposing the Kids Online Safety Act? Evan Greer is director of the group Fight for the Future. She'll tell us what's going on there. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. As media critics, we encourage people to write letters to the editor, noting that even if your letter doesn't run, it may help another letter with a similar point get in, because a paper that gets one letter may not feel obliged to represent that view, but if they get 20, they may figure they should run one. All of which is to say the New York Times must have got a boatload of letters scoffing at columnist Ross Douthat's Sad Sack May 17th piece about how legalizing marijuana is a big mistake, not least because his opposition to it is making people call him a square. Unsurprisingly, Douthat isn't being a principled contrarian, just obfuscating. As noted by Paul from Washington and Jeff from Queens and Peter from Boston, he sidesteps comparative mention of legal drugs like alcohol or tobacco and dismisses decades of society-wide harms of racist enforcement of anti-marijuana legislation by saying cops who used weed as a pretense to stop and frisk black people will just find other reasons. So much for that. For the Times columnist, it all comes down to the wicked weed as personal degradation, which in 2023 sails like a lead balloon. There is an informed good faith conversation to be had about the impacts of marijuana legalization, and especially the effort to see some of the benefits of this newly legal market in some places go to those most harmed by its illegality. Our guest works on precisely these intersections. Tahid Chappelle is a founder of the Philadelphia Cannabis Association and also a project manager for Free Press's News Voices project, focusing on that program's Philadelphia initiative to reimagine how local newsrooms of coverage of crime, violence, and the criminal justice and carceral systems. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Tahid Chappelle.
Thanks for having me.
So Douthat's column was headlined, "Call Me Square, but Facts Show the Error of Legalizing Weed," which okay, the invocation of facts is a rhetorical device. You all are vibing, but I'm a grown-up who only traffics in facts. It's a frankly boring tactic that people use to discount the humanity of others and think they're doing something. But, you know, I love a good fact as much as the next guy. So in terms of public opinion, in terms of reported social harms, in terms of the information that we do have, would an observer say that marijuana legalization, where it has happened, has been a big, dangerous mistake?
No. In fact, I'm happy to say that because legalization for both medical and adult use legalization has been around, especially on the West Coast in places like Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and California, we are now starting to see the long-term studies of the impact of legalization. There's been a fear that teen use is going to go up. That's been debunked by the studies on these various states over the last decade of legalization. There's been fear about higher road rage or higher traffic accidents due to being quote unquote under the influence of cannabis. That's also been debunked. There's been ongoing fear about marijuana use being some sort of gateway into harder drugs. That has been debunked. And we've also seen a decrease in opioid use in states that have legalized cannabis for medical use as well. And so there has been a lot of reefer madness that continues to point at unscientific, non-peer-reviewed data that does not actually support the ongoing fears that people continue to fearmonger across the country. We have a plethora of data, a plethora of government back studies as well to show that the legalization of marijuana has been nothing but a net positive overall.
Well, let me ask you another side of information. Are people still being arrested for marijuana possession? Because media would tell me that it's all the Wild West and that's why we might think about putting the genie back in the bottle, but it's not exactly the case.
Yeah, in states such as like New Jersey, and even, you know, we're pulling from data from the West Coast because they've legalized longer as well, we have seen an overall decrease in arrests for cannabis possession.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean that Black people are not still being disproportionately targeted for cannabis. We are still seeing that across the country. In fact, the ACLU did a wonderful report that shows that incarceration, especially for Black Americans, still has not significantly decreased despite legalization of marijuana. And an example of this is in Pennsylvania, where medical marijuana is legal. However, if you are not a medical marijuana registered patient in the state and you're not in a city like Philadelphia or Harrisburg or Pittsburgh, which has decriminalized cannabis possession, if you are caught with marijuana with you and you're not a medical marijuana patient, you still could be criminalized and potentially incarcerated from police if you step out of those decriminalization areas. So that's to say, yes, overall, we are seeing a positive decrease in arrests, but that does not mean that Black people are still not being disproportionately targeted for marijuana use or possession.
Well, I know that you have a Philadelphia focus. Are there things that are happening right there that are emblematic that you think point to larger issues? What's going on in Philadelphia that you think is useful to think about?
We've noticed that municipalities, ultimately, when it comes to cannabis legalization, the state will create usually sometimes broad categories of how the cannabis market should be rolled out. But municipalities at the very local level determine what types of cannabis businesses they can allow in their cities, mm-hmm. right? They have zoning ordinances, they have permits, they have specific locations that businesses can and can't operate. And so something that I encourage everybody, especially those that are interested in getting into the industry, is to start educating your council members, your county commissioners, because this is something that's completely new to them. Many of them have never been exposed to marijuana as a legal business. Many of us have gone through decades and generations of marijuana as a harmful drug, it's a narcotic. And so to see this become legalized where there are actual business and economic considerations, many people, especially lawmakers and politicians, still don't have enough information to make the best decisions on how to make an accessible an equitable and friendly cannabis market where people can be participants without the fear of any sort of retribution or incarceration. So education, education, education. Philadelphia specifically, we had a big primary where we are going to have a new mayor coming up this year. That means more education for them because they may be the mayor that has to oversee legalization in their city. They're going to have to figure out what types of cannabis businesses they're going to want to allow in Philadelphia. Who should have those licenses to operate and where should they be able to operate? And what types of support should they be receiving? So municipality to municipality, you have varying levels of education. Some mayors embrace legalization. They're excited for it. They want to see the financial returns of these new businesses. Others are very much NIMBY, not in my backyard. They're still afraid of it. They still think it's going to create a drug market in their backyard. And so we have a lot of level setting to do at the local level.
Well, let me ask you finally about journalism. A million years ago, except it was actually January 2018, I talked with Art Way from Drug Policy Alliance, and this is at a moment where Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, was saying, quote, good people don't smoke marijuana, close quote. And we had a Kansas State Representative, Steve Alford, who said in 2018, not 1918, said that we need to remember why marijuana was outlawed, which was because, quote, African Americans, they were basically users and they basically responded the worst off to those drugs just because of their character makeup, their genetics, and that, close quote. So there's obviously a opinion shift, a culture shift happening, but in terms of media, what would you like to see? New questions asked, new ways of approach. What would you like to see in terms of media coverage of the issue?
There are three people that I like to point to as really good examples of good reporters asking tough questions,
mm-hmm.
holding politicians accountable, agencies that are supposed to be doing the job of rolling out legalization but have not. One of them, the former Boston Globe journalist Dan Adams, who covered the Massachusetts legalization for years, great reporter. Jelani Gibson, who was the first Black reporter in a traditional newspaper to cover cannabis. He works for NJ.com. He holds the state accountable, asking a lot of politicians, asking a lot of regulators questions about expectations, realities, what the law has been said and what has actually happened pertaining to the law. And then from a national perspective, Mona Zhang from Politico does a great job in analyzing how different governments are trying to address the ongoing inequities that we see in cannabis legalization. And I think that continues to be a point that we need to emphasize, is that despite legalization, the people who have been harmed the most are either still locked up or being released but not being supported into the reentry of society. And they're not able to still be able to benefit from the true legalization, which is being able to legally run their own cannabis operation and be supported in that too. So I would love to see more media reporting on the ongoing inequities and the solutions that other municipalities and states are trying to do to rectify the situation. I think more awareness of that is going to lead to a lot more, I guess, inspiration for cannabis advocates and stakeholders to bring these solutions to their lawmakers and politicians in their respective localities.
All right. Well, I suspect we'll speak with you more in the future. Tahid Chappell is founder of the Philadelphia Cannabis Business Association, as well as a project manager for Free Press. Thank you so much, Tahid Chappell, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate everything that you do. Truly an honor to be included in this interview.
Louisiana just banned abortion at 6 weeks before many people even know they're pregnant, while also saying 16-year-old girls are mature enough to marry. Arkansas says there's no need for employers to check the age of workers they hire. As one state legislator put it, there's no reason why anyone should get the government's permission to get a job. And Wisconsin says 14-year-olds, sure, can serve alcohol. Iowa says they can shift loads in freezers and meat coolers. Simultaneously, and in the same country, we have a raft of legislation saying that young people should not be in charge of what they look at online. Bone saws cool, TikTok bad. The way this country thinks about young people is odd, you could say. Incoherent would be another word. When it comes to the online stuff, there seem to be some good intentions at work. Anyone who's been on the internet can see how it can be manipulative and creepy. But are laws like the Kids Online Safety Act the appropriate way to address those concerns? We'll talk about that now with Evan Greer, director of the group Fight for the Future. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Evan Greer.
Thanks so much for having me. Always happy to chat.
Well, let's start specifically with COSA, with the Kids Online Safety Act, because it's a real piece of legislation. And there are things that you and other folks are not disputing, that big tech companies do have practices that are bad for kids, and especially bad for some vulnerable kids. But the method of addressing those concerns is the question. What would COSA do that people may not understand in terms of the impact on ostensibly those young people we're told that they care about?
Yeah, and I think it's so important that we do start from the acknowledgement that big tech companies are doing harm to our kids, because it's just not acceptable to pretend otherwise. There is significant evidence to suggest that these very large corporations are engaging in business practices that are fundamentally incompatible with human rights, with democracy, but also with what we know young people and really everyone needs, which is access to online information and community rather than having their data harvested and information shoved down their throat in a way that enriches companies rather than empowering young people and adults. And so when we look at this problem, I think it is important that we start there because there is a real problem. And the folks pushing this legislation often like to characterize those of us that oppose it as big tech shills or whatever.
Right.
It's hard for me not to laugh at that, given that I've dedicated the better part of my adult life to confronting these big tech companies and their surveillance capitalist business model and working to dismantle it. But I think it's important that we say very clearly that we oppose these bills not because we think that they are an inappropriate trade-off between human rights and children's safety. We oppose these bills because they will make children less safe, mm-hmm. not more safe. And it's so important that we make that clear, because we know from history that politicians love to put in the wrapping paper of protecting children any type of legislation or regulation that they would like to advance and avoid political opposition to. It is, of course, very difficult for any elected official to speak out against or vote against a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act, regardless of whether that bill actually makes kids safer online or not.
Right.
And so what I'm here to explain a bit is why this legislation will actually make kids less safe. And it's important to understand a few things. So one is that COSA is not just a bill that focuses on privacy or ending the collection of children's data. It's a bill that gives the government control over what content platforms can recommend to which users. And this is, again, kind of well-intentioned, trying to address a real problem, which is that because platforms like Instagram and YouTube employ this surveillance advertising and surveillance capitalist business model, they have a huge incentive to algorithmically recommend content in a way that's maximized for engagement, mm-hmm. rather than in a way that is curated or attempting to promote helpful content. Their algorithms are designed to make them money. And so because of that, we know that platforms often algorithmically recommend all kinds of content, including content that can be incredibly harmful. That's the legitimate problem that this bill is trying to solve. But unfortunately, it would actually make that problem worse. And the way it would do that is it creates what's called a broad duty of care that requires platforms to design their algorithmic recommendation systems in a way that has the best interest of children in mind. And it kind of specifies what they mean by that in terms of tying it to specific mental health outcomes like eating disorders or substance abuse or anxiety or depression. And basically says that platforms should not be recommending content that causes those types of disorders. Now, if you're sticking with me, all of that sounds perfectly reasonable. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we want to do that? The problem is that the bill gives the authority to determine and enforce that to state attorneys general. And if you've been paying attention at all to what's happening in the states right now, you would know that states' attorneys general across the country, in red states particularly, are actively arguing right now today that simply encountering LGBTQ people makes kids depressed, causes them to be suicidal, gives them mental health. They are arguing that providing young people with gender-affirming care that's medically recommended and where there is medical consensus is a form of child abuse. And so while this bill sounds perfectly reasonable on its face, it utterly fails to recognize the political moment that we're in. And rather than making kids safer, what it would do is empower the most bigoted attorneys general, law enforcement officers in the country, to dictate what content young people can see in their feeds. And that would lead to widespread suppression, not just of LGBTQ content or content related to perhaps abortion or reproductive health, but really suppression of important but controversial topics across the board. So for example, the bill's backers envision a world where this bill leads to less promotion of content that promotes eating disorders. In reality, the way that this bill would work, it would just suppress all discussion of eating disorders among young people. Because at scale, a platform like YouTube or Instagram are not going to be able to make a meaningful determination between, for example, a video that's harmful and promoting eating disorders, or a video where a young person is just speaking about their experience with an eating disorder and how they sought out help and support and how other young people can do it too. In practice, these platforms are simply going to use AI, as they've already been doing, more aggressively to filter content. That's the only way that they could meaningfully comply with a bill like COSA. And what we'll see is exactly what we saw with SESTA-FOSTA, mm-hmm. which was the last major change to Section 230, a very similar bill that was intended to address a real problem, online sex trafficking, that actually made it harder for law enforcement to prosecute actual cases of sex trafficking while having a detrimental effect for consensual sex workers who effectively had online spaces that they used to keep themselves safe, to screen clients, to find work in ways that were safer for them, shut down almost overnight because of this misguided legislation that was supposed to make them safer. And so we're now in a moment where we could actually see the same happen, not just for content related to sex and sexuality, but for an enormous range of incredibly important content that our young people actually need access to. This is cutting young people off from life-saving information and online community rather than giving them what they need, which is resources, support, housing, healthcare. Those are the types of things that we know prevent things like child exploitation. But unfortunately, lawmakers seem more interested in trampling the First Amendment and putting the government in charge of what content can be recommended than in addressing those material conditions that we actually have evidence to suggest, if we could address them, would reduce the types of harms that lawmakers say they're trying to reduce.
Well, thank you. And I just wanted to say I'm getting reefer madness vibes, you know, and a conflation of correlation and causality. And I see in a lot of the talk around this, people pointing to research. Social media use drives mental illness. So I just wanted to ask you briefly, there is research, but what does the research actually say or not say on these questions?
It's a great question. And there's been some news on this fairly recently. There was a report out from the Surgeon General of the United States a couple weeks ago. And it is interesting because, as you said, there is research. And what the research says is basically it's complicated. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, our mainstream news outlets and politicians giving speeches don't do very well with complicated. Mm-hmm. And so what you saw is a lot of headlines that basically said social media is bad for kids. And the research certainly backs that up to a certain extent. There is significant and growing evidence to suggest that, again, these types of predatory design practices that companies put into place, things like autoplay, where you just play a video and then the next one plays, or infinite scroll, where you can just keep scrolling through TikToks forever and ever, and suddenly an hour has passed, and you're like, what am I doing with my life? There is significant evidence that those types of design choices do have negative mental health effects for young people and adults, and that they can lead to addictive behaviors, to anxiety, et cetera. There's also evidence in that report that was largely ignored by a lot of the coverage of it that showed that for some groups of young people, including LGBTQ young people, there's actually significant evidence to suggest that access to social media improves their mental health.
Right.
And it's not that hard to understand why. Anyone who knows a queer or trans young person knows online spaces can provide a safe haven, can provide a place to access community or resources or information, especially for young people who perhaps have unsupportive family members or live in an area where they don't have access to in-person community in a safe way. This can be a lifeline. And so, again, there is research out there, and it is important that we build our regulatory and legislative responses on top of actual evidence rather than kind of conjecture and hyperbole. But again, I think what's important here is that we embrace the both and recognize that this is not about saying social media is totally fine as it is and like leave these companies alone and we can all live in a cyber libertarian paradise. That's not the world we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
These companies are big. They are greedy. They are engaging in business practices that are doing harm, and they should be regulated. But what we need to focus on is regulating the surveillance capitalist business model that's at the root of their harm, rather than attempting to regulate the speech of young people, suppress their ability to express themselves, and take away life-saving resources that they need in order to thrive and succeed in this deeply unjust and messed up world that we are handing to them.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Evan Greer. She's director of Fight for the Future. They're online at fightforthefuture.org. Evan Greer, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. That's also the place to show support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Des idéales, détruis d'abord les monstruosités. Gouvernement, caserne, cathédrale, qui sont pour nous autant d'absurdités. Dès aujourd'hui, vivons le communisme, ne nous groupons que par affinité. Notre bonheur naîtra de l'altruisme, que nos désirs soient des réalités. Debout, debout, compagnons de misère, l'heure est venue, il faut nous révolter. Que le sang coule et rougisse la terre, mais que ce soit pour notre liberté. C'est reculer que d'être stationnaire, on le devient de trop philosopher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Empare-toi maintenant de l'usine, du capital, ne sois plus serviteur. Reprends l'outil et reprends la machine, tout est à tous, rien n'est à l'exploiteur. Sans préjugés, suis les lois de nature et ne produis que par nécessité. Travail facile ou besogne très dure n'ont de valeur qu'en leur utilité. Debout, debout, compagnons de misère, l'heure est venue, il faut nous révolter. Que le sang coule et rougisse la terre, mais que ce soit pour notre liberté. C'est reculer que d'être stationnaire, on le devient de trop philosopher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. On rêve amour au-delà des frontières, on rêve amour aussi de ton côté. On rêve amour dans les nations entières, l'erreur fait place à la réalité. Oui, la patrie est une baliverne, un sentiment doublé de lâcheté. Ne deviens pas de la viande à caserne, je ne conscris, mieux te vaut déserter. Debout, debout, compagnons de misère, l'heure est venue, il faut nous révolter. Que le sang coule et rougisse la terre, mais que ce soit pour notre liberté. C'est reculer que d'être stationnaire, on le devient de trop philosopher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Ta pensée invoque ta confiance, avec la science il faut te concilier. C'est le savoir qui forge la conscience, l'être ignorant est un irrégulier. Si l'énergie indique un caractère, la discussion en dit la qualité. Entends, réponds, mais ne sois pas sectaire, ton avenir est dans la vérité. Debout, debout, compagnons de misère, l'heure est venue, il faut nous révolter. Que le sang coule et rougisse la terre, mais que ce soit pour notre liberté. C'est reculer que d'être stationnaire, on le devient de trop philosopher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Place pour tous au banquet de la vie, notre appétit seul peut se limiter. Que pour chacun la table soit servie, le ventre plein, l'homme peut discuter. Que la nitro, comme la dynamite, soit la pendant qu'on discute raison. S'il est besoin, renversons la marmite, mais de nos mots a-t-on la guérison. Debout, debout, compagnons de misère, l'heure est venue, il faut nous révolter. Que le sang coule et rougisse la terre, mais que ce soit pour notre liberté. C'est reculer que d'être stationnaire, on le devient de trop philosopher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher. Debout, debout, vieux révolutionnaire, et l'anarchie enfin va triompher.
This government had an idea, and Parliament made it law. It seems like it's illegal to
fight for the union anymore? And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Set off to join the picket lines, but together we cannot fail. We got stopped by police at the county line. They said, go on, boys, or you'll go into jail. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Well, it's hard to explain to a crying child why her daddy won't go back. So the family suffer, but it hurts me more to hear a scab say, sod you, Jack. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? I'm bound to follow my conscience, and I'll do whatever I can. But it'll take much more than a union law to knock the fight out of a working man. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Been before. Soon one man owned half a million acres on both sides of the Hudson River shore. He invited families to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they pay the rent. His name was Van Rensselaer. He became one of the richest men on earth. In today's terms, $90 billion is how much he'd be worth. All this for doing nothing but saying all of this was his. I have the power of the state behind me, and I'm in the landlord biz. After 200 years of this and one revolution won, another Van Rensselaer had another son. This Rensselaer was greedier than his ancestors dead and past. It was the 1840s, and things were changing fast. It was the straw that broke the back. The bottle was uncorked. They started organizing meetings, the tenant farmers of New York. They found the strength of numbers. They found the power of suggestion. They found each other asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord? To live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? They vowed they would stop the rent collection. They vowed they'd bring this madness to an end. And when one blew the tin horn of distress, he soon found he had 1,000 friends. With calico skirts, masks upon their faces, on horseback, armed with knives and guns. They chanted and they yelled, and they kept their farms, and they kept the sheriffs on the run. They asked, who gave you the right to be a landlord? Live a life of ease while others toil. Who gave you the right to be a rich man? All the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil. Mm-hmm.
governor's militias tried to stop them, but nothing could be done to break their will. And by 1848, the landlords buckled, sold their holdings to the farmers in the hills. Yes, they overthrew this feudal system, but it's replaced now by speculators and banks. And you can still hear the homeless families asking of all the landed gentry in our ranks, who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right?
Stop. We're
Good afternoon, listeners. It's an incredible Tuesday. Like I said in the first hour, it's probably not even going to get above 80 degrees today, maybe 75. It's a very cool day, almost spring-like, really almost spring-like. Meanwhile, we have John Grant from outside Philadelphia, where there are no bridges, I guess. There's no bridges there, John. Did you have a bridge burned down?
Well, on I-95, there was a bridge that went down. It was, some poor truck driver with a truckload of gasoline was going too fast into a curve under an I-95,
uh-huh.
And he was going too fast, and he... So he slid into the bridge abutments, and the thing bust open and exploded.
Oh, that's how it happened. He ruptured the tank.
It was quite a dramatic fire there. It'll take months. I-95, which connects Key West, Miami.
Well, Key West.
The Maine is now cut off in Philadelphia for like 3 months.
Well, who wants to go to Florida? I mean, I can't believe it. Why would you want to?
Speaking of which.
Well, hey, really, is it going to be that big a deal just to have a detour? I guess the volume of traffic on that particular mm-hmm. interstate artery through Philadelphia is so heavy that even a detour is going to cause traffic jams. Is that how?
Well, the detour has to, people are going like 70, 80 miles an hour on this road, right? Now they got to get off and go through Kensington or whatever the hell it is in the city. They're trying to figure out routes. But, back in the late 70s, I-95, if you were coming north on I-95, Washington, D.C. to New York, you ended up in some goddamn cornfield with a sign like, where the hell am I supposed to go? And it was going on for a long, long time. And the two roads didn't connect, and you had to figure out how to get from the end of I-95 to the beginning of I-95 going north again. They fixed it. And so now they kind of got a similar problem, I guess, but it's, and it gave me bad vibes, because, my God, all you got to do is fill up a truck with gasoline, get a, somebody to go under these little overpasses, and kaboom, the arteries are cut off for months,
Yeah. Well, I don't know, in Kansas City and even to a certain extent Topeka, there are, when they built the interstate, yes, it was basically an intersection in the urban center. But as the sprawl from suburbia, and I've watched this over the last 40 years in Kansas City and Topeka, as the sprawl develops, they build these rings. I call them rings out here in Kansas City, in Kansas. It's I-435. It's got three numbers. 435.
And it's one of those circle jobs.
Yeah, and it goes around, crosses over, all the way around into Missouri and Kansas, all the way around the urban area. So because what I saw that bridge, that's sort of a downtown bridge, isn't it? That burned down.
Well, it runs along the east side of the city. So it's not really downtown. It runs along the east side and the river is along there and, just shoots north. And as I say, it's just a little road that went under the highway. And, therefore, there was an underpass or whatever you'd call it, underpass. And it was in that little underpass. He was going too fast and it kaboom. And it just, it burned. What happens is, there's a steel understructure to holding the bridge up, and at 700 degrees, if it cooks for a while at 700 degrees, it cuts the strength in like a third. But if it goes to 1,000 degrees, which this would have done, it cuts the strength of that steel in half, so that all the concrete on top of it then just drops it.
Man, oh man! Well, it was big news out here, almost everywhere.
Yeah,
the bridge falling, especially as our man Donnie, the orange baboon, is
there
on
he
his
is.
What he ha- he's
Right.
I don't know. I don't think he's got out of his entourage, but I can talk about traffic jams.
I haven't seen. I watched cable for a while this morning, but then I got to cooking my beef rendang, so I never finished that up. But he apparently they don't want any video or still pictures or anything to remind people of what happens today. So they're they all arrange that his giant black SUV, unbarbered SUV, will duck into the garage underneath the court building, and he will get out in the elevator and go to his arraignment court, and then he will get back in the elevator, get back in his barber and black car, and shoot out. So no one's going to see him this time like they did last time. The Miami mayor, I heard, was it you that said reports of 15,000 people or something?
The chief of police, I'm going to be quiet, it wasn't me. It was the chief of police of Miami, who sounded sort of like a Cubano. He said that it was they were ready for crowds from 15,000.
Right.
But then a later report.
What they're ready for. But this morning, sharp-looking Hispanic Miami mayor named Suarez said he expected about 100 protesters.
I've been watching helicopter footage of it. I could say it's less than 500, but it may be growing. It could be growing. It did seem to be growing as the closer his orange imminence approached the federal courthouse. And it really looked to me like many. Morbidly obese and outraged, overage white people. It was all. I mean, it was just. There were several brown and black, but mainly, it was a circus, and it looked like a market, an open market.
People with big trucks who eat too much barbecue,
and they're grifting. They're grifting their Trump flags and their T-shirts and. I mean, it looked like an open marketplace for a bunch of swag, people that sell swag, like outside of rock concerts.
Well, CNN had what they call a town hall last night, which I watched for, an hour and a half, of Chris Christie running down Trump, calling him all kinds of narcissistic bastards and all this, And this is a guy who, he talked about the corruption. He talked about what is this with Jared Kushner getting $2 billion with a B, $1 billion from the Saudis after the regime was over. And, of course, let's not forget, Chris Christie put Jared Kushner's daddy in jail, federal prison. He put Jared Kushner's dad in. That's why. The report was that Jared Kushner was so tight with Trump that, that Chris Christie had no chance of being attorney general or anything like that. He was not permitted into the administration. And so, his loyalty is now zero.
Put my daddy in jail.
Well, it sounds like, if he were Attorney General now, or he'd be ready to put his sonny boy in jail, too.
Well, even
let's wait and see.
Well, even former Attorney General William Bill Barr, B-A-R-R, Donnie, his own Attorney General said, that he's toast if half the charges are.
He said, if half of the stuff is true, he's toast. And this is only the first of what? He's got one criminal indictment already. This is the second criminal indictment. He's got one in Georgia coming up. And he's got the major big banana coming up in about January 6th, an insurrection coming up in Washington. So he's going to have federal felony criminal court hearing or trials in Atlanta, in Miami, and in New York. And in Washington, he's got in four cities. He is facing federal felony charges. I mean, dozens and dozens of them, you know. And as this one has shown, hey, this one, you know, is like a steel trap. There's no getting out of this one. You know, they've got some English major to really tone it up in a narrative sense, you know. And, you know, because what courts and trials are, if we really basically want to admit, they are a struggle in a, you know, formal courtroom between two narratives. Which narrative, which story, literally, which story is the jury going to believe? Well, this narrative is pretty tight. And as we know, if you listen to Fox News and, you know, the MAGA loyal people, their thinking is not very tight. Their thinking is very, very loose when it comes to the art of bullshit and fantasy and fabrication and fake news and all that stuff, you know, this post-truth world that we live in. Barr, I think, has got it right. You know, this man is going to be toast. With people like Chris Christie going after him, going to the juggler now, Chris Christie's point he made over and over again was, you know, Donald Trump got away was, you know, talking shit, basically, you know, talking street shit. You know, it's not formal political bullshit and lying. This is informal, you know, no holes barred street talking shit. And he took that to the political debates. Well, Chris Christie says, hey, I'm doing that now, you know, and he called all kinds of names. And he said, yeah, you know, if we have these debates, the first one, Donald will decide not to do it because he's too big for that. But after what I talk about in these debates, he's going to come to the second one. You know, so Chris Christie is really going for it. And and Luann and I were going like, wow, the guy's an artist. He's a political artist, Chris Christie. It's incredible. this huge, fat man is such a political artist. I would not vote for him, but, you know, it's like, whoa. You know, you don't want Chris Christie, you know, in the opposite corner at a political punching match, you know, it's like...
Well, it's a hobgoblin of democracy.
you
have to pick... I mean, I suppose if it was only Trump and Chris Christie, and I still felt like I needed to vote, I would probably vote for the morbidly obese, outraged guy.
Yeah, so would I. If that were the only choice, I'd go with Chris Christie. A center-rightist. You could say, you know, sympathy with him if you have it. He was valiantly trying to carve out a center-right political position for a post-Trump Republican Party that would elect him, of course, as president in 2024. And by the time, you know, they're talking about fast-tracking this trial and having it within, like, you know, less than three months. So this trial could be, what, July, August, September? This could be late September and October in fall. Well, then there's other trials, too. When, are they going to have synonymous trials? Is he going to have to go to Miami for a trial and go to Washington back and forth so he can sit at these trials? This is, like, unprecedented. You know, that's an overused word, I guess, you know, but
now this is really new,
you know, and of course the question that hovers over the whole goddamn thing is violence. In other words, he is doing everything he can to try to encoded fashion stir up some kind of violent response, you know, like he did on January 6th. That somehow can, you know, like a surfboard, get him, you know, to ride the wave in. Well, good luck, pal, because you got a lot of negatives, a lot of baggage. You know, you'll be carrying around a lot of baggage, and, you know, your mojo may be affected by this, and people are going to start asking questions like, wait, why do we so obsessed with this guy, you know?
Right.
And, you know, as the, what I call the Wile E. Coyote outcome. Luann and I, my wife, used to see him as like James Cagney in White Heat, you know, top of the world, Ma, kaboom, you know,
right,
at the top of that gasoline tank. But now I see him more as Wile E. Coyote, you know, in the scenes in the Roadrunner and Coyote where
this is dropping.
The coyote goes over the cliff, and he's about 6 feet over the edge of the cliff, and he's like standing there, and he's stopped, and his eyes get real big, and he looks at us, and he looks down, and he goes, he basically doesn't say it, but he basically goes, oh, shit. And then he falls all the way to the bottom of the canyon. Way down there's his little poof, you know.
Well, you think God, so King
Old
Donnie
orange hair could go that way, you know.
It'd be, I don't know, a little poof. I'll tell you, a little poof, Donnie has succeeded in stopping tens of thousands of cars going into Miami, leaving his Doral golf course resort, which I understand is different than Mira-Lago. I don't know.
Right.
Yes.
I don't know. Is Doral in Florida?
Wait,
Bedminster? He's got a half a dozen of these things.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, you live down there. You've been down there.
Hmm.
Is there how far apart is Mira-Lago to Doral? Is that's a secondary real estate holding of Mr. Trump? I mean, it's sort of a...
Well, Mar-a-Lago is at Palm Beach, right? West Palm Beach.
Yeah, West Palm Beach.
Well,
yeah,
I don't know where Doral is. It's on the Gold Coast there somewhere, I guess.
Well,
but the Gold Coast goes from Miami all the way up to Daytona Beach. It's just this, you know, huge, you know, Florida Gold Coast. It's the Gold Coast.
Well, they got a lot of cops, I'll tell you that, because I saw the...
Yeah.
Live feed I was watching this morning, and out of the Doral Golf Course Resort, there came at least, I lost track after 200 motorcycle cops, and I swear half of them were grinning ear to ear as they came out of the golf resort gate and going back by the media village that was camped outside the gate, and that was a good hour before, and then they did this procession of dozens and dozens of black and white Suburbans came out, and they had to drive across down, I guess, Miami, and they, helicopters are over him. I watched it foot by foot as the procession, and one person I had on captions so I could just read what was going on, and it said, and I was thinking this as it came on the captions, it said, this is like a slow version of the O.J. Simpson.
My wife and I watched the original live O.J. Bronco thing, and you know, funny, believe it or not, I had a dream one night, and I told my wife this, and she loves it. You know, I used to, in Vietnam, I'd fly around in Huey helicopters, you know, over the Saison River or whatever, with the doors open, the air coming in, you know. I almost fell out of one of them, but it's a long story. But I had this dream that I was on a canvas seat in a Huey with the door open, and the breezes were coming in, and we were over the ocean. And we were following a white Bronco, which was like a porpoise in the ocean. It was going boom. Yeah, I had this dream. It was totally Freudian dream. I don't know what it was, but it was this great dramatic dream of following the white Bronco like a porpoise in the water.
In the water.
Now, well, that makes no sense at all, does it? But in some...
Well, in this case, it was like a whole pack of orca killer whales going down the Miami,
a
Florida
pod,
interstate.
I think they call it a pod.
Yeah, it was endless. I mean, and I'm watching, I'm thinking, oh, the crowd is definitely now over 500. I'm looking at the crowd now. It's a lot larger.
All right.
It's growing. They're whipped up. But like you said,
what are they
like going to
do?
Earlier,
they can do nothing.
Yeah, there's no Antifa.
There's
two people that had dressed in jail stripe uniform holding. Okay. Donnie's guilty sign. He got practically manhauled by the cops out of there.
Yeah, he'd be dead meat if he's only one person.
Yeah, the security, the expense of this security is so outrageous. And there's Secret Service inside and out.
I mean,
we're paying for all this. We're paying for this free publicity.
Well here's an interesting question. You mentioned Secret Service.
Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting question. Okay, they put Donald Trump in some prison like Allenwood here in Pennsylvania where everybody wears civilian clothes, they even play golf, I think, and things like that.
Wow.
You know, where the big guys go. And, you know, they'll obviously put him in some special prison like that. But he has to have Secret Service protection, even in jail.
Yeah, that's like a gang. That's having your own gang. Yeah, your own gang.
Well, I mean, think of the Secret Service guys that have to go to prison for 10 years, you know,
and protect this
motherfucker from Democrats who might be in prison, you know. It's I mean, this is all new territory, you know what I mean?
Well, I just can't help but think that everybody on the wrong side of my railroad tracks are enjoying this, because I don't see any – I mean, this guy is going to walk down for 10 minutes. Maybe some poor jail clerk will get brave and says, well, I've got to do your fingerprints and get your mugshot. Maybe.
Right. Here, sign this piece of paper while you're at it. Give me a signature.
It's sad that all this for a 15-minute court appearance, and this is just the beginning. I really can't help but think that there is a chance for violence. I think there is, but only if there's any resistance.
Well, you know what I said. 2024 is going to make 1968 look like a joke. You know, I mean. I don't know what that means. What I just said, but I have a gut feeling that today, I would not worry. You know, with all the security they're gonna have in Miami, you know,
and
obviously they're not gonna go out with their pants down like they did in D.C. on January 6th. That's never gonna happen again in the place where the action is, if you will. The problem is, in classic guerrilla warfare, and okay, we could say also in classic cases of stochastic random violence. It's on the periphery. It's on the outside. It's on a place that they don't expect you to hit. That's what guerrillas do. You know, there's this big base here, but then there's this little base over here, and nobody's really protecting that. And so you clomp on that, and you make a big scene, and you kill a lot of people, and you make a big story. So if they think like that, look out in, Boise, Iowa, Idaho or something, some FBI office in Missouri or something. Lunatic who wants to make a big deal, you know. Yeah.
Right. Well, I got to tell you, I learned it from my convict brothers, who had spent a lot of time in jail. Not Mark. He's a good guy. Okay. He's a truck driver.
I think of Mark often, and his tunnel metaphor. You know, I think of it. We're living in Mark's world of what the fuck country this is after we came out of the tunnel. Right?
Well, this is about loosely related to truck driving. I'll tell you that.
Right.
The late night, because I have this little radio, earphones, just little earbuds, and I go to bed, and you can set it so it automatically shuts itself off, so I just turn it on. It's portable, totally portable, and I'll go to sleep with that and go to the news, and it's a digital thing, just scroll right through all your favorite right-wing radio stations, because that's all that's out here. And you go through it, and that's the Philadelphia Bridge.
Yeah.
When it happened, and I don't know when this is at night or
like
early afternoon.
3 days ago, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, but what time of day was it, day or night?
That's a good question. I think it was probably during the day because I saw some fire scenes. It seemed like daylight, yeah.
Well, it could be. Well, it might be in 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe. But from there and after.
I don't know, really. I don't know.
It was a terrorist attack. It was fever out here. That's what they were saying. This was a terrorist attack. You know what
I mean? Well, as I indicated earlier, I mean, this is a model for a terrorist attack. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not right about it. I'm just telling you that was the other.
Well, no,
look
what the Ukrainians did to that bridge of Crimea, you know? Same thing, basically, right? A truck full of explosives or gasoline, and you drive it out in the middle of the span, and it's either a suicide rider or, you know, the guy has a wetsuit on and jumps in the water, and boom, you know, I don't know.
But
a boat picks them up. But
these people, the country, I think the population's on edge, and now these are right-wing talk radio stations that are out here, and I thought, what the hell's happening in Philadelphia? And the only one that sounded sane of any of them was one that said, "Well, the bridges are falling down anyhow. We don't fix them."
Well, I don't think this was. I mean, obviously, this shows how vulnerable our infrastructure is to accidents, or could conceivably be, I suppose, a terrorist act. But you know, the driver was a fine fella, black dude, and his brother was in tears. You know, this was not expected, obviously. And you know, it was a case of maybe he was tired, and you know, pedal to the metal. He's running late, and there was a curve. It curved to the left. You know, ultimately a 90-degree curve. Under this span of 95, a little short span. It wasn't long. Well, he obviously suggested the what happened is that he came in too fast. He did.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't know that spot, and he realized, oh shit, an oh shit moment, you know. And he hit the brakes, and it just careened over and split the tank and sparked kaboom. It was gasoline, you know, one of those volatile substances. You know, this happened to a woman I used to work with at the Philadelphia Business Journal. She got off work one day, and she got onto the Spring Garden entrance to the Schuylkill Expressway. And one car ahead of her, and then there was a tanker exploded right in front of her. And everybody, I guess, backed out. She came back to work. She was devastated. We all, fluffed her up and all this. But she, you know, kaboom, this huge fireball right in front of her. So, this, you know, these things go up. You know, all these trains that, you know, Rachel Maddow keeps track of.
Not in Kansas. This is flat land Kansas. Flat land, John. And when people cross over a river, we call it the bottoms. We call it the bottoms. We have whiskey bottles named West Bottom Whiskey. We do. We have. And,
you mean like in bottom land or what?
The bottom land all ends up silting down to the river, and that's where they call it the bottom. And
that's
so
the
it's
real
actually,
bottom.
You know,
I guess the river would be the lowest point. Obviously, that's where water.
Yeah, and all of our topsoil is going into the river because we're a bunch of fools and idiots out here. We have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun doing it too. But that's what people out here said. Well, the bridges is either nobody's taking care of our bridges. We all know that, or it's a terrorist bombing. Let's hope that's not.
Or it's just an accident, a case of stupidity.
Right.
You know, he's going too fast, and he's sleepy. God knows what else. So don't know. But as I say, one of the things that came to my mind is, you know, if you get about 20 people to do this, you know, with tanks and bombs and things, really can muck up a society like the United States when you cut the arteries like 95 and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to give anybody ideas though. I mean,
it's hard to believe. It's very hard to believe. I go with Occam's razor that it's basically the simplest is the right. The one you described of fatigue, inattentiveness, driver, pilot error. I totally agree. Well, why do I think it's, we have fuck-ups in Kansas City interstates, but they're like that on these curved ramps. But when the wind, right. We have wind, and when the wind hits these big semis, we've had, I know at least one cattle car blow over on the highway, you know, crossing one of these overhead overpasses, and they they blow up and the cattle are sprawled. Then you get a helicopter view from a local TV station of the cattle running down the highway to downtown Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh,
now that is something to think about. Wild cattle on the interstate running to the, down to the rich people in the downtown part of the of Kansas City. It really happened. I just sort of step back and think, well, that's sort of poetic, if you ask me, you know.
But these are, to me, classic oh shit moments, accidents.
Oh,
you know, things that happen.
Yes, of course,
we can attribute that to like wars, like Iraq. You know, I mean,
you can imagine
one day Donald Rumsfeld in his office, and he gets bad news from Iraq. Oh shit!
I could talk that dumbass in the Oval Office into doing this. Iraq.
Right.
I mean, we could definitely do Afghanistan. Everybody in the world wants to do it. Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora. Everybody wants to. Although we won't do that to
Right. But the Iraq war became an oh shit moment. It is basically a historic oh shit moment because, you know, George Bush Jr. doesn't show his face because of the Iraq war.
Well, not only that, I think he realized, I don't know at what point, that's a question for historians.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did George Bush Jr. get an inkling that, I screwed up? I mean, it did happen because he obviously doesn't.
Maybe it was in his bathtub. That's why he kept painting his bathtub, his toes. He had an oh shit, oh my God, what have I done? God, there's nothing I can do about this, you know?
I think Laura.
And so
Laura.
Joe Biden understanding the poor man's political position, and Joe Biden loves to kiss ass of Republicans. You know, he had here in Philadelphia a famous thing. He was the head of the Constitutional Center in Philadelphia. He's the head guy on the board, Joe Biden. And
really?
This was when he was vice president.
They had this
special thing where he put some peace medal for Philadelphia around the neck of George W. Bush and Laura Bush. And there were a bunch of my friends outside, Iraq vets and whatnot, screaming, shame, shame, shame. And I got inside because I had press credentials. And so I got inside, and I was like, I was calling my wife outside on the line saying, you gotta work on your cheer. Shame, shame. It's getting a little, you know, give some space and articulate it loud as you can, because you can hear it in here. You know, I was coaching them from inside. And the only people that did the coverage on that was Russian television, RT. And RT did a great story, and you can hear George Bush is speaking here. Shame, shame.
While he's speaking.
Yeah.
And Joe Biden, future president.
And Joe Biden arranged for him to get this medal.
Right.
So he could tell about all the wonderful things he's doing for Iraq vets, because of him got wounded in Iraq, and now he's all for them. And so, you know,
that would be a great photograph if there is. Wonder who took it. Somebody. Unsung. Mm-hmm. Hero photographer has got a picture of Joe Biden draping some metal around the neck of George Bush.
I have a picture of it. Somewhere. I took a picture of it.
That is a picture worth...
I did a story. I did a whole This Can't Be Happening story.
Considering Ukraine and Biden and Iraq, and I mean, this is, oh my God, that's a great, that photograph of these, you put that on face on the on social media, dude, it'll go viral like crazy. If you
well,
the right
again,
headline.
it was online. I don't know. It was a while ago.
Picture. Well, you need to send me
I'll find a story for you and send it to you.
Yeah, I need that picture. That would make a great slide on your slideshow, on your show today that we do. I mean, that's
we're doing a little online opening of our show. I think three essays that I wrote for This Can't Be Happening that trashed Joe Biden. And so I did these three, and then I told everybody to vote for him.
Well, you know, look, I really never considered, he was a nobody when it's Obama. And I was just sort of like, you know, all I knew of him was that he was from Delaware and he represented credit card companies. And I hate him, you know. I just like, he's another rich blob, you know what I mean? It's what
he plays up Scranton and this working class thing, you know.
But everybody,
my animus towards Joe Biden comes from when I was a flak photographer at Widener University. And he was speaking during the drug war, when he was doing all the drug war stuff. He spoke at Widener because it's convenient for him on the train, you know, on the way down to Delaware. So, you know, it's close. And so he spoke, and I was a photographer for the university, so I took his picture. And then I sat down to listen to it because I was working with needle exchange groups and whatnot in the drug war at the time. And I decided I'd stand up and ask him a question. And so I stood up and waved my hand, and he sort of walked over a little bit. He's, you know, a little ways, you know, 15 feet away from me. And I says, you know, Senator, your drug war, what do you think of decriminalization and harm reduction programs and things like that? Well, I might have, you know, said something obscene or something. I don't know, because he then ran over to, I was in the second row, he ran over right in front of me, and he points his finger right in my face, and he says, "This guy thinks he's smart." I go, "Oh, shit, man, what the fuck have I done?" And he ripped me down. You know, this guy, he wants to legalize, he's smart, he thinks he's smart, he uses the word decriminalization. He wants to legalize drugs. He wants your children to have, you know, this kind of stuff. And I'm going like, oh my God, what have I done? Because my job is going before my eyes, you know. I mean, if I said what I said to Senator Hines once at the Germantown Library and he threatened to throw me out, if I say that to him, like, listen, Senator, you're not answering my question. Answer my goddamn question. I mean, in another context, I would have done that. But I would have lost my job. I liked my job, you know.
He knew that.
The prick knew that. And I'll never forget that. I will never forget that. Because that was real attack dog stuff that was – there was – I mean, he knew I had a good question. He knew damn well that his drug war crap that he's doing, you know, these more police and, you know, putting black people in jail. He and Clinton helped do that. And he knew what I was about. He knew I had the right question. And so he just attacked the questioner. He attacked the messenger. And, you know, I will never forget that. I mean, this is the way the guy operates. You know, this is the way the guy rolls. You know, he'll come up and give your wife a back rub while you're getting an award, you know.
The most dangerous thing I thought of him at the time was that, in the aftermath of Donnie, I thought, well, he'll be a caretaker. And that's all we need right now is a caretaker just to recover after four and a half years of Trump madness, and then he does Ukraine with Loudy. I mean,
a lot of them would have done Ukraine. I don't know. Trump might would.
What if Zelensky said "fuck you, Donnie"? What would Donnie do? I mean, you know, anything possible.
It would have been different if Trump had won the re-election. Absolutely. You know, and of course, Biden has a classic sort of LBJ sort of spin about him. He's a good legislator. He knows how to bust balls in the legislature. He knows how to, you know, kiss ass with Strom Thurmond and all that in order to get bipartisan things going. He's a, you know, backslapper and all this kind of stuff.
He's good at that. There's no question. There's a large number of Republicans that supported the financialization of the war, of the proxy war in Ukraine.
So he's basically the center-left version of the center-right position that Chris Christie's trying to carve out. And, you know, Biden is, of course, the center-left. And, of course, you know, what I've said many, many times is that when America goes to its extremes, and, of course, MAGA Trump is an extreme if there ever was one, that because of fear, because of what, or listening to American boilerplate out of the Constitution, whatever it might be, that America hews to the center. It gets a smell of extremism, and it maybe gets frightened, and it kind of gravity hews it down in a groove in the center. And so you can see that happening, you know, with last night for an hour and a half, Chris Christie trying to carve out the center-right position so that you have an election in 2024 between a center-leftist and a center-rightist, which is going to take America to the center, whether it's skewed to the left or the right, we'll find out, versus this populist idea of Donald Trump as an extreme right, white supremacist coded extreme right candidate. Well, the original, to me, political injustice here is from Hillary Clinton. Absolutely. That gang, they used their clout and nefarious sorts of things to make it impossible for someone like Bernie Sanders, a populist socialist on the left, to have this very interesting presidential election in 2016, which we didn't have, between a populist rightist fascist, if you will, and a populist leftist socialist. You know, a democratic socialist running against a democratic fascist. And that would have been one hell of an election. And I am convinced Bernie Sanders would have won that, because labor would have gone to Bernie Sanders, and, you know, we don't know. We don't know. This was, you know, the deep state Democrats maneuvered it so we could not have that election.
Let's shift gears just to name. Okay. The New York Times, and I didn't get to report his name, and I should have. My apologies to the old gray lady. There was an article in there smearing, doing a roundabout sort of a, I don't know what you'd call it, a tickle, about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s wife. Her name is, listeners, her name is Cheryl Hines. Now, Cheryl Hines played on Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David.
I know. I remember. I like Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's a very sort of liberal show. And apparently is married to this whack job, Kennedy.
Well, that's what I wanted to hear. What do you think of this whack job? I think he's got a great
I mean, he comes up with he's buying a lot of these conspiracy theories, apparently, because there's power in, you know, like, surfing on these conspiracy theories. I don't know. He seems like a flake to me. I don't know.
Well, all he's got to do is say that capitalism is a conspiracy, and he's got my vote.
There you go.
But he, you know, he goes way. He's an environmental lawyer. He goes way, way back to early YouTube. He used to appear with a guy, I can't remember, Palatino. I can't remember how you pronounce his name on. Show called Ring of Fire.
Okay, I don't know.
And so you can, I'm telling the listeners, you can look it up, Ring of Fire on YouTube, and you can see RFK Jr. and this other guy doing these shows, and they're doing incredible lawsuits against corporations that are polluters, major polluters. And I know that. And then he got smeared with this anti-vax. He's not anti-vax. I've studied it because I know about this a little bit. He was one of the first consumer rights lawyers to come out and oppose. He used experts to point out that the use of small amounts of mercury in early childhood vaccinations could be a could create autism, at least maybe autism, as a symptom of the mercury poisoning that you do when you give them these these infants these multi vaccines. Dr. Chris, my wife, wouldn't delay Tristan get vaccinated until he was like 6 or 7. Because of these, because they were, you know, they're in the hospital, they're get born, they get this.
Oh, this is a good caution, probably.
And that is what he was against. He's not against vaccines, and he questions the way and I know doctors, not Dr. Chris, he hasn't told me this, but other doctors who have said that the way they manufacture the vaccines now, this new molecular way of mixing them rather than going the old way, should be peer reviewed and rigidly studied because it's all new. The way they manufacture the new vaccine.
Yeah, especially the warp speed. I think that Trump brags about getting the vaccines for COVID. I mean, if Donald Trump did anything worthy, that's one of the things he did, this warp speed idea. But, of course, a lot of the right turned against the things. You know, so, you know, it's so confusing that you don't.
Right. Well, you got to go.
Yeah, and maybe putting something on warp speed, maybe it should be peer-reviewed in a serious way. But, of course, all these people right are attacking science. The whole thing, they discredit science like they want to discredit the rule of law. I mean, the justice system in America is corrupt and fucked up already, and they want to destroy it, you know? They trash science, and so how do you have a study when you trash science?
Well,
you know?
You get to the numbers on data statistics, and it's real simple. None of the throwbacks, the after effects, counter indicators are substantial enough to warrant a major field study yet. Although the federal government is doing field studies on the aftermath of the use of the warp speed vaccines and the boosters.
Right.
Those studies are
going to go on. Yeah, they should.
Yeah, that's why we pay these motherfucking and lab tests.
Absolutely. And if there's a problem with these vaccines and 135 people died because of them, we need to know this, you know. I don't know.
I don't know. Over, a million and a half Americans dead, higher than most countries in the world. They were counted, an estimated 16 million dead worldwide. So, I mean, it's sort of the numbers are incredible. I'm back at the lot, speaking of numbers. The live feed from Miami has the helicopter view has. I would say it's still nothing. I mean, maybe
500 people.
Maybe more. No, but I mean, it's still a ragtag operation.
Right.
This is
exactly.
Not, this is not a.
I mean, if January 6th is the
this is
the bellwether,
red guard.
the model. Well, listen. They're fucked because they're never going to be able to mount anything remotely like January 6th. People are too savvy. The deep state, if you will, the hated FBI, they're all on it like you-know-what on you-know-what. And so it's going to be ragtag or it's going to be stochastic kind of crazy lunatic violence, and in the end, it will probably. My view, I'm rather optimistic. We'll end up with a reasonable government that will start cutting back on AR-15s and things like that, which may incite people to shoot more people. But you know, I mean, I think we have to go through some violence here before we come out the other end. I hate to say that, but that's my gut. And I have no official position. I'm not saying that officially, but
well,
my gut that there's no way out here, you know, and it's going to be probably lunatic, stochastic violence that in the end makes absolutely no sense, you know.
Well, I hope they just quit picking on Cheryl Hines. That's all I got to say.
Right.
I like
that. She's very funny, you know, and Larry David is hilarious. You know, he loves to send up liberalism. You know, he trips over things, and you know, he's a clown. He's wonderful.
Well, okay, but I want you to double check me on that Gray Lady article because I thought that was sort of abuse.
Now, when was that?
It was 3 days ago.
And what was it about again?
It was about RFK.
Oh, right.
RFK Jr., yeah.
Yeah, I don't trust him. Yeah,
I know. I'm trying to change your mind on that.
Well, you know, the guy that's really interesting is Cornel West. Cornel West is running for governor, for president.
President, yeah.
You know, Cornel West, a black philosopher. He's done rap albums. He's worked at Yale, Harvard, Princeton, and every other. You know, he's a character. Cornel West. He's highly respected as a pragmatist philosopher, and you know, a school of the pragmatism with that goes back to John Dewey and William James and all those famous American pragmatist philosophers. Pragmatism is the only thoroughly original American philosophy.
Well, he's going to have to come a long way to the flatlanders, I'll tell you that.
But of course he's one of these guys who's going to stir it up. He's eloquent, he's always wears like tuxedos, and he has frizzy hair, and he's a total literary character. And he's a bit of a preacher, and he's got the cadence.
Yeah.
And he and Marianne Williamson, who's also running, who I like, Marianne Williamson, I really like her. She writes books on spirituality and all this kind of stuff. And she's talking about very smart, decent human cooperative things, and spirituality and so these two people are going to be in the Democratic debates, plus Robert Kennedy Jr., Marianne Williamson, and Cornel West. I mean, I can't wait. Talk about entertainment.
Only the Democratic Party, what's left of it, could put together a ticket as wild and zany as that. I mean, Marianne Williamson is smarter than the right wing, the Republican version of Mike Pence. I mean, she's
no question.
I've listened to both of them, and little bit the guy with the helmet, the hair, that fly face, Mike Pence.
Ooh. Oh.
Mike Pence, the guy with the fly on his head that nobody.
The guy who refers to his wife as mommy, I think.
His mommy, yeah. The guy is totally.
But he runs around in a Harley now. He's like strapped on a hog the other day.
Sam Brownback, listen, a word of warning as we close the show. Word of warning to America. Sam Brownback did the same goddamn thing. He got himself a motorcycle and drove around Kansas before he ran for governor. And it was the worst fucking thing we ever did was to put Sam Brownback. Sam.
Sam Brownback. Yeah.
Well, Saint Sam. We call him Saint Sam because he is so religious. He's so religious. I mean,
Sam strapped on his Harley, man.
On his Harley.
And
so. I'm sure Mike Pence got that idea from Saint Sam.
Right.
I'm telling
you. Harley Hogs for Jesus. Okay.
Well, it's been a great Tuesday with you. We didn't get to cover everything on the list, but we got most. Well, we got to feel. Right. I want to finish with it. William Barr, Bill Barr, Billy Barr, who called Donald Trump toast over the latest criminal indictment.
Toast.
William Barr was called in response by Donald Trump, quote, a gutless pig, unquote.
Well, again, you should hear what Chris Christie say on another fat guy like Barr. He's talking about as a mirror hog. He calls him a mirror hog. And they played a little bit of his piece, and Christie he couldn't wait. He's tripping over himself. See, he's a baby. He's a child. He's infantile, you know. And he's like, yeah. He's in his sandbox. He's crying. No, and I'm going like, my God,
Donald. He's going after Donnie. Poor Donnie.
Poor Donnie.
All right, we'll close the show. Tristan, hit it, Tristan. Let's get out of here.
Hey, Tristan, go for it.